I'm Debbie Dashinger. Welcome to Dare to Dream. Be inspired to live big and bold and take action to turn your dreams into your reality. Go beyond obstacles and limits of your thinking. Accelerate results to catapult yourself to success. I'm a visibility expert who gives media makeovers to clients, booking them on media interviews and turning their books into international bestsellers with guaranteed results. Join me at DebbieDashinger.com. Dare to do great things. Dare to shine. It's all about you becoming a visionary and leading the pack. Welcome to your daring new life.
And we are live at the Conscious Life Expo, February 2019. And this is Rob Rowe standing in for Debbie Dashinger of the Dare to Dream podcast. And I have the immense good fortune to be here with Steve Kotler. Steve, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to take off as a launching pad here. What I want to ask you about is Lionzorn and empathy tracking, okay? What is that? That is the character and the premise in your new novel that's not even out yet. I had the very good fortune to read an advanced copy. So you've thought a lot about cultural shifts in society. You've thought a lot about what might influence that. You've thought a lot about the subject of empathy. In fact, our protagonist, Lionzorn, is what you called an empathy tracker. So What is an empathy tracker, and can you tell us a little bit about how this character actually functions with that kind of a career?
So, to back into empathy tracking for a second, I was looking at the question of what does it take to fracture a species, right? And it doesn't take a whole lot in nature, right? A river is enough to sometimes split a species. For most of, you know, recent history, we've been the dominant. Well, there's only one. You know, Homo sapiens were the only dominant hominid species, but throughout history, there were lots. And so there's a bunch of different forces, whether it's genetic engineering, whether it's the fact that we're going to go into space for the first time this century, et cetera, that are going to start exerting those kinds of pressures. One of the things that was really interesting to me, and this is the story that I tell in the book, is that as a general rule, people who are on the spectrum didn't reproduce a lot, so that talent stayed within kind of the human function. But with Silicon Valley, people who are on the spectrum are prized, right? Usually for their whiz-bang math skills, and the social stuff is tolerated, right? You can work with it. So people who are very high-functioning on the spectrum are mating, basically, for the very first time at high frequencies, right? So a couple of generations from now, right? Like, I was interested in the book I talk about, because there's a lot of Frank Herbert references, and we're like Mentats, which are his logic bomb walking computers. How would you get that? Well, you would take math whizzes who are on the spectrum and breed them together for a bunch of generations, and you could start to produce something along those lines. So that's one. In the empathy thing, what we know is, and this is just interesting in general, that each generation seems to be more empathetic than the prior ones. So there's work, I want to say it's at a Harvard in the adult development, that say that millennials, for all the problems they have in the world, are as empathetic in their 20s as folks in my generation were in their 30s or 40s. Right? And empathy tends to widen over time as we age. You gain, if you do the work, right? If you do the personal growth work, you move up the adult development scale, and one of the things you gain is empathy. So all this stuff is known and tracked and whatever. So empathy seems to be this thing that's evolving more into us, one way or the other. Maybe it's in culture.
Mostly
maybe
through life experience.
Hard to say. I mean, culture is shifting, right? And where we draw our in-group, out-group lines are changing and shifting. I just, you know, started thinking about what would happen if, in the way that like people on the spectrum breeding together could produce hyper-analytical minds that are like not quite human, right? You fractured the species. Now you're literally genetically changing things. What happens if empathy could be developed that way? So an M-tracker is not just interpersonal empathy, he can feel empathy at a cultural level, so he can actually feel emotionally how culture is going to shift in the future. And, you know, it's a useful skill for a certain kind of company, is the line that I say in the book. So, like, obviously there's corporate benefits in the way, like, he's sort of like the cool hunter of tomorrow, basically, like, but nth degree out from that, I would say. And it was sort of a way of looking at a lot of things, especially looking at, you know, the central core theme of the book, if there's one theme, I think, is that if we're going to survive the challenges that we're facing over the next century, especially environmental challenges, empathy has to be empathy for all. It's got to be empathy for not just humans, but plants, animals, ecosystems. Otherwise, we're not going to care enough about the natural world to avoid the crisis that we're now facing. So that's some of the ideas that I was playing with.
So in the book, there's a couple of interests. It was very kind of Game of Thrones-ish a little bit, in that there were, you know, different players that kind of had their own agenda that they wanted to further, and they were all kind of interrelated. We had a sort of a Google-ish type of mega corporation, Arctic corporation. We had a billionaire basically, you know, heading it up, sort of maybe a Richard Branson-ish kind of character. And then we had sort of this underground movement that was all very mysterious in the beginning, and it started to sort of come to light, and you called them the Rilkeans. And they had a different approach to the empathy thing. Arctic Corporation wanted to look at commercial interests, and there's always going to be that. You know, I've talked to some psychics here who are real psychics, and there's definitely a commercial interest there. Imagine being able to predict the stock market next month or next week. Some people are actually doing that. With the Arctic Corporation, they wanted to gain control of the empathy sensing trend, if I'm correct.
They were trying to get control of a pharmacological drug that could expand empathy.
Okay.
The Rilkeans, so Rilke, empathy as a, historically, this is super interesting. The evolution of empathy in culture, empathy as a word doesn't show up until the 1800s. And what's interesting about it is Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher, says the limits of my language are the limits of my world. And what he means by that is language shapes perception at a really deep level. And so religions have been trying to get us to live nicely together for thousands and thousands of years with, let's say, mixed results.
At best, right.
So, but the word empathy shows up in the mid-1800s. It comes out of art theory. They're trying to figure out, how is it that when I look at a painting, I get a mood that was actually the painter's original mood, right? So how is this feeling transferred through the medium of art into another human being? And so there's a whole bunch of people who are trying to solve that problem, think about it, and empathy comes out of that. And literally within 10 years of the word showing up in culture, slavery is outlawed almost everywhere. The women's rights movement starts, black rights movement starts, animal rights movements all start within a decade of us finally having a term for this thing that we share together.
Was that kind of the beginning of the upper turn of the hockey stick to where we're now?
Where we are now, yes. And so Rilke, the poet, was one, he was very big part of the movement. He called empathy my superpower. So what most people don't know is, when we know the famous Rilke quote, live the questions. Rilke felt empathy was the best way to live the questions, right? So he literally was, you want to know something? Walk a mile into somebody's moccasins kind of thing, right? And sure. So the Rilkeans are, and it, like, they started out as kind of a counterculture punk-ish movement that turned into sort of a belief system. And, you know, one of the questions that I look at in the book is how culture shifts and how religions get assembled, right? And the characters have sort of cobbled together their religion from Rilke and from some psychedelic stuff and blah, 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 blah. And I'm just kind of looking at how that gets stitched together. But, you know, what the question I'm asking is, obviously, what would it take to really create this kind of empathetic movement, right? So we could actually empathy for all plants, animals, ecosystems.
And sort of the mechanics to that, if I'm not mistaken, you're suggesting sort of, you know, tie back to what Frank Herbert suggested in the terraforming of Dune, with the Fremen being led by a messiah-like figure, Muad'Dib, who basically unified all the Fremen on Arrakis and, you know, created something that then shifted the history of that planet for centuries into the future, and Arrakis eventually became a paradise.
I'm trying to do it without, like, the cult, right? Like, Muad'Dib, it was the terrible thing, right? He had to become this cult leader, and he unleashes all kinds of holy war and you know, right-wing religious fanaticism, and in this case, it was probably left-wing jihadism, religious jihadism, whatever. And right, so I'd like to avoid that particular outcome. But Herbert, you know, one of the things that I think he saw more than anybody, and that's why he's so feature prominent in the book, is that environmental collapse leads to huge, massive cultural shifts, and it tends to blend cultures together. So, like the Fremen were a mashup of Zen Buddhist, Islamic extremists with left-wing American mid-60s environmentalism, right? Like, yeah. That's what he mashed together to create his Fremen. So I mashed a bunch of things together to create the Rilkeans. But it was the same kind of issue because, you know, how do you kind of prepare culture to deal with environmental crisis is, you know, a question that I was looking at. And I'm also, I have to say, I'm kind of a Darwinian. So I don't like, you know, I've had friends who use the term cultural architecture and shape, like as if you could do that. I sort of think this is way too complex and it's not predictable and there's randomness in the system and you don't, like, you can't shape culture. It goes haywire.
Well, I don't know. I think you kind of made some suggestions here and there in the book about some parallels with where we are now in the 60s. Obviously, you know, a mind-altering substance figures prominently in the book. And then, of course, in the 60s, we have Leary and Alpert and LSD and some serious cultural shift going on there. And we came out of the 60s far different than we went in as society.
You make an excellent point. That's one of the other things I think. I don't know if I go as deep into this as maybe I should have. But one of the things that I'm really paying attention to is the technologies for drug discovery, right, across the boards, whether it's we're starting to develop 3D chemical printers so we can print the drugs from scratch wherever. Both early level quantum computing and AI is really pointed at drug discovery and with user-friendly interfaces, meaning like you and I could jump onto an AI, point and click with a printing device on the back end. So like what I think about is think about how much culture has been shifted by psychedelics. And until Alexander Shulgin really comes along in the past 20, 30, 40 years, there's a limited, like you're talking 10, 12, 15 substances globally, right, that people had access to. Shulgin added another couple hundred to the pharmacopoeia, of which maybe people use 10, 15. Think about how much culture has been changed just by this. And now we're about to get DIY psychedelic underground chemists playing with stuff. Like, where it's going over the next 10 to 15 years in terms of pharmacologically aided consciousness exploration, like it's about to become an open source movement, right? Like this has been rarefied air and suddenly everybody's going to be able to do it, and that's interesting.
Well, you had mentioned in your acknowledgments that you are personally aware of chemists at this time experimenting and maybe getting close to success with mind-altering substances that can actually affect empathy.
Yeah, there are a bunch of different people who are playing with it at a bunch of different levels. I mean, but this is not, I mean, obviously MDMA, that's, you know, has, you know, can extend empathy. Marijuana, absolutely, openness to experience, openness to other people. So we know substances can do this already. So we have a good understanding of how norepinephrine and dopamine produce romantic love and how oxytocin produces trust. And, you know, we're starting to get some of the foundational ingredients. So this, like that work is going on and people are extending it out. I mean, I did a story for Rolling Stone back in the 90s about a bunch of biker chemists who had found a way to create a hallucinogen that you only hallucinated in smells. Everything else stayed normal, wow. But your smells, like, I...
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So, like, this is... Now, that was back in the 90s. So the cutting edge of this stuff is really cutting edge, and it's... Right now, the recipes are open source. Like, it's all available. So it's really... I'm really interested in how that's going to impact culture. And, in fact, in the new book I'm working on with Peter Diamandis, nonfiction books about exponential technology and what's coming, at the end of the book, it's a very... it's the next 10 years that we're looking at. So a lot of the world that Last Tango is set in, where did it come from? Well, it came from the actual hard research, Peter, I've been doing on disruptive technology and what's coming in the next 10 years. At the end of the book, we look 100 years out. And I talk about the five great migrations that I think are going to start unfolding over the next 100 years. And, you know, obvious space being one of them. But another one is into interior spaces, because we're getting so good at the technology and the pharmacology of state shifting and these experiences that it's going to start unlocking all kinds of wormholes. Maybe not for the better, but we're going there.
Well, there are maybe some certain parallels to, you know, the 60s, with, you know, Leary and Albert and LSD, but there's some things that are very different. We've got psychedelic use coming from individuals and companies even, and promotion by individuals that have very, very large resources. We've got, I understand even sometimes people say 80% of Silicon Valley is microdosing on psilocybin or LSD. How does that bode for the kind of cultural shift when we have kind of more of a top-down awareness? There's obviously a huge psychedelic renaissance going on. We were talking earlier about Michael Pollan's work in using psychedelics. I think it's, you know, pretty much common knowledge by now. It has extremely beneficial effects on addiction, PTSD, end-of-life depression, opiate addiction with ibogaine, things like that. But the big question is, what effects, used responsibly, used in a controlled environment, can mind-altering substances affect a average or above-average person who wants to be exceptional? Where do you see that going?
I think that 80% number is massively overstated, by the way. I've never heard it that high. There is a lot of microdosing in Silicon Valley, but that number seems really high to me. But I actually don't know. And I also have to say that the psychedelic use that I'm seeing, 98% of it is wildly inappropriate. And, you know, it's just drug party behavior by another name. Like, just because you've got a fucking shaman in the room doesn't mean it's real. At all, and doesn't, you know, shaman is a word that I don't actually think means anything. Like, I don't even know, you're right, but all that's besides the point. So what we know, and this is James Fadiman's research, right, on microdosing, so sub-perceptual doses of LSD and psilocybin produces like a 200% boost in creativity in his early research. So it was the last... his microdosing study with a bunch of executives in Silicon Valley, right? It was, and he brought together, it was like 30 or 40 people who had failed, been trying to solve a super technical challenge for like 3 months. So new design of a particle accelerator, new design of a space satellite, that kind of stuff. And he, you know, they did experiment with microdosing of mescaline and LSD, and as a general, the laundry list of new products that came out of these sessions is huge. And on general, people reported like a 200% boost in creativity. That's what he said. Now, that was the last real study that anybody's done on it. There are a lot of people who are poking at this again. But it's really, we're, my organization, the Flow Research Collective, have teamed up with a CBD cannabis THC company because we're looking at cannabis creativity and flow states as a way to improve performance. And it's everybody in this community on the research side, and you're right, there's amazing sober research that's been done, and these chemicals are incredibly useful for a treatment of all the things you listed and more. They're really scared about the high performance stuff. It makes them very, very nervous. Because it's not like, it's one thing when you're curing PTSD or end-of-life anxiety. These are intractable conditions with, you know, OCD, which is another one that psilocybin has been promising, cluster headaches. All these conditions are devastating to people. That's one thing, and there's a whole regulatory structure meant to deal with it. But performance enhancement, everybody's really nervous about it. It's certainly going on, and more research is coming. And, for example, at my last organization, the Flow Genome Project, we teamed up with Imperial College in London, where Robin Carter-Harris's lab is, where they're doing all the fMRI work on psychedelics, really great work. And we teamed up to look at a comparison between flow states, being the zone runners, had those that stuff, and psychedelic experiences. Just sort of comparison and contrast baseline. But what we're trying to get at is, what is the ultimate innovation protocol, say you need to be creative, you're trying to solve a really hard work challenge, what is the best blend of, say, kind of flow state, state-shifting technologies with maybe a pharmacological technology, with maybe a respiration mindfulness technology? Like, how do these things stack together? Because everybody knows, everybody in the community, there's kind of an overwhelming consensus that nobody wants to talk about out loud because for obvious regulatory reasons, but everybody sort of seems to believe is that the best protocols for probably for both for trauma and for high performance are going to involve combinatory therapies. It's not just going to be meditate or try this substance or, you know, blah, blah, blah. It's going to be some
sure,
blend of these
know,
things together.
Multi-pronged is always
yeah,
best.
Yeah, always best.
Medicine and everything.
And you saw it. I wrote a story called The Psychedelic Renaissance, oddly enough, let's say 10 years ago. And it was the underground. It was right at the beginning of where all this research started to get really real again. Roland Griffith at Hopkins has done his work. A couple other people had done their work. But I spent time with an underground psychedelic therapist who was doing end-of-life work with multiple, you know, cannabis, MDMA, psilocybin, LSD, meditation. He was that sort of thing, and very effective, very underground. But obviously, this is becoming more and more mainstream. So I think we're getting to combinatory therapies. And I think we're going to see it in high performance as well. I just think it makes people nervous. But you know, clearly, certain things, and it's not across the board, right? Like these are very specific substances to solve very specific problems with. And they work well for, you know, certain kinds of things. And microdosing works well for certain kinds of things. And there's heroic doses, right? And that seems to work well for certain kinds of things as well. But it's really, really clear, I think, that once a year, twice, you know, like those are sober use rates for a lot of people.
Yeah, we're finding that, you know, single doses will, you know, cure a soldier of PTSD in some cases.
Indefinitely, right?
Like maximum two or three doses.
Well, yeah, I mean, right, like the early MAPS study on MDMA with Michael Mitherhofer, Dr. Mitherhofer, was done 8 years ago now, and the PTSD is still in remission from a single dose, right? So clearly these things are effective in low doses, and I just think they make people too wobbly. And nobody abused psychedelics more than I did when I was in my 20s. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, I absolutely am as guilty of it, but the combinations that people are using right now are really potent, and they're really, like, I'm meeting whole generations of, like, smart people in Silicon Valley are just wackadoodle on drugs.
Well, I think there's a matter of, you know, personal responsibility, personal acceptance of risk. If you're going to, you know, use fire as a tool to warm your house, you've got to be careful not to burn your house down.
That's,
you know,
exactly.
So I think you and I would agree that the government doesn't really have that much of a place in telling us what we can and cannot put into our own bodies, but the government's going to disagree, and the wheels of government turn slowly. But outside of that, it seems that there is definitely progress moving in that direction. I mean, just look at the states that are dropping like flies for recreational cannabis. Pretty soon it will be all of them. So there's kind of an unstoppable trend in motion here. Let's say some of these concerns can be dismissed. What does it really look like for somebody maybe who's interested in flow, maybe, you know, a technologist, a scientist somehow, maybe an extreme athlete, if they wanted to bring a mind-altering substance into their protocol just to push the envelope and do it in a responsible fashion?
I got to tell you, that's not like, I try to stay in my lane. That's outside my lane. I work on flow. I have a good understanding of the neuropharmacology and things like this, but certainly I would never, ever give anybody advice on how to use psychedelics. First of all, if you have schizophrenia in your family, like psychedelics are harmless pretty much, unless you have schizophrenia in your family. And if you have schizophrenia in your family, and I have an uncle who was my father's brother, brilliant man, brilliant athlete, went to San Francisco in the summer of love, took some acid, and has never come back. Full-scale schizophrenic break. Like, so I've seen, you know, all sides of this up close. Nobody knows if that's what set him off, but, like, that's, you know, what the research consistently shows. So, like, you know, it's irresponsible to start recommending, you know, this stuff to anybody until you've at least investigated that particular question.
Understood. So you've done a lot of association with Peter Diamandis, also, you know, one of my favorite guys. I've followed him a lot. He's talked a fair bit with Dave Asprey. Some, you know, phenomenal conversation. I've read some of his stuff. You're continuing to work with him, right?
Yeah. So we're on our third book. It's coming out next February.
Is there any up-to-the-minute stuff you can share with our listeners? Peter Diamandis is fascinated with the subject of immortality and conquering death. He's got a couple companies dedicated to that. I remember one of his Cellularity, probably a couple other companies. Phenomenal entrepreneur. Can you talk about anything that not be widely known to the public that you can still discuss that's happening on the horizon with Peter?
I'm not going to talk out of turn about my friend Peter, but I will say, Cellularity is a stem cell company, on the longevity front. It is starting to get interesting, right? We now have a pretty good idea that there are 9 main causes of aging, and there are interventions or potential interventions targeted at all of them. Senolytic medicines are really, really neat that target, for example, zombie cells. Do you know?
So I've heard the term.
A zombie cell is basically, it's a cell that can't die, right? It stops functioning and it can't die. And so what happens is it's like rotten strawberry. It will infect the cells around it, like mold spreads in a fruit basket. And they're just zombie cells, right? They're not dead, not alive, and they cause mass amounts of inflammation, which is one of the main causes of death. So there's a whole slew of medicines that are targeting that. Peter Cellularity is a stem cell company. I think over the next 10 years, stem cells get real, right? Like I wrote about stem cells back in the 90s when there was a new technology, and then it was essentially a right to life argument, right? It wasn't, nobody could forget about cellular medicine. Like we were still fighting right to life stuff. Now I think we're going to start seeing our first real medicines this way. Gene editing to fight disease is going to become a real thing. And the thing that is the most mind blowing to me is the work that one of my heroes, Martine Rothblatt, is doing on 3D organ printing. So she's been working primarily on lungs, right? Cool. And they're teamed up with Cellularity. So Martine's company is teamed up with Cellularity because she's working on 3D printing lungs and pulmonary stuff. And you have to kind of reboot the lungs with stem cells. So it's a combinatory approach. But literally, it's 3D printed, biologically based replacement body parts.
So you'd mentioned yesterday that even with today's technology, about 50% of the body parts are
well, yeah, we can replace about 50% of the human body right now with bionic body parts.
So an arm or a leg, a foot, I've seen something I remember talking about, somebody that had like a bionic, a mechanical hand, almost like Terminator.
Yeah, you gotta understand, like you can 3D print. I tell a story in bold about a young boy born without a left arm, and he went to a summer camp in San Francisco. He was 14-year-old Aiden Robinson. His name is Aiden Robinson. Mm-hmm. And he was born without a left arm. He went to a summer camp in San Francisco, and he came back and 3D printed himself kind of a bionic replacement arm. This arm has so much dexterity. He can handle a grape, and that's a raisin. Those are when they test fine motor skills in bionics, that's the thing. Can you hold a grape? He can play the violin with his homemade prosthetic bionic arm. He can practice his violin. He could build with Legos.
With a bow?
Both. Both.
Really?
This is, I think he, his neck. Actually, it's the neck. But I've seen him bow with it too. It's literally like this is a kid on homemade technology. So imagine what's going on at the cutting edge.
Oh, totally. Steve, it looks like we're going to have to wrap it up. Where can people find you to learn more about your work?
StephenKotler.com, StevenKotler.com.
Well, it has been a thrill, and congratulations on The Last Tango in Cyberspace. I can say from personal experience, it's one of the most awesome books out there. So anybody who's listening, highly encourage you to check it out. Take care, Steve. We'll see you around.
Thanks, Rob.
It's a wrap.
What if there's nothing wrong with you? What if you're far greater than you've ever given yourself credit for? What if it's time to know the gift and the contribution you are to the world, and to like yourself a lot more? Hi, my name is Dane here. 13 years ago, I started to truly ask questions. Actually, I started to be the question, and everything changed for me. Asking questions opens doors to infinite possibilities. And it's not about finding the answer. It's about being the question. Always. What I'm inviting you to step into is something that Einstein, Marie Curie, Newton, Da Vinci, Gandhi, Picasso, and Aristotle all knew to be true. What if no question is too big or too small? What if anything is possible for you? What if together we could create a kinder, gentler, happier world? Is now the time? Go to beingyouclass.com and sign up for a free video series, My Gift to You. Beingyouclass.com. What if you, truly being you, are the gift and change this world requires? Beingyouclass.com.
Because in your book, yes, thank you, Last Tango in Cyberspace, Lion Zorn, in his past, had a relationship with a woman named Sonia, and she was someone who led the Animal Liberation Front, which for me seemed like a parallel to your life with your wife, Joy, having founded the Rancho de Chihuahua Dog Sanctuary. Is that a true connection?
Well, the ALF is a real thing, and the ALF were much more extreme. We run a dog sanctuary. We're a 501c3. I think the ALF spent some time on the government's terrorist watch list. So different kind of, you know, the ALF was about breaking into monkey research centers and freeing primates and things like that. So, but I was... I've had two different women I was involved with before. I have a thing for animal geeks. I like women who like animals. So I had a couple of girlfriends earlier on, especially back in my punk rock days. There was a big animal rights arm of the punk rock movement that sort of came out of the crass commune in London. And so I was exposed to it very early on and, you know, sort of passionate about the cause from very early on.
And so you talked about hospice care at your sanctuary. You talked about a long-term rehabilitation for special needs dogs. You know, I don't know, frankly, how you have the heart to do it. I also understand how could you not have the heart to do it. But that's really a big undertaking. How do you go through that gestalt with each of the dogs? Because you must get so connected and in relationship with them.
I'll be totally honest. So we do everything nobody wants to do. I live and work in the second poorest county in America with the highest incidence of animal cruelty. So we are directly on the front lines. It's very poor here. It's hard living. We do hospice care and special needs care, which nobody wants to do. And when we started, my wife's point was, let's do everything nobody else wants to do. I'm tough enough to take it. What about you? And I think I said yes before I knew what the hell I was getting into, is in all honesty. And now it is so strange because I have, like, I can tell you that if, depending on how close I am, most dogs, unless I'm really close to them, and we've probably worked with 500 or 600 animals have come through our facility over the past decade. I know that the bereavement cycle is 3 days. And that for 3 days, I'm going to be crazy and I should not talk on the phone and I should not have conversations outside of, with people. I'm like, because my reality is going to be so tilted and I won't know it. So I've got, like, at this point, I've got grief protocols because so many animals have lived and died. And for me, it's awful. Every time it's awful. I don't think you ever get used to having your heart crushed. Like, it's just like death is death is death. And when you love something and it, you know, and it dies, it crushes you. That there's no, you know, it doesn't get better with practice. At least for me, it hasn't gotten better with practice. And my wife, I haven't seen it. You know, you're not at the only thing, you know, that's a little helpful is it's going to end because you've done this so many times, right? Even when I'm totally destroyed, when it's one of my best friends, and I'm crazy for a month or 2 months, I know it's going to end because I've done this before. So there is that. But I do think, I don't know if I'm like other people could do it as well. I don't think there's anything special about me. I just don't think other people would run the experiment to find out they were tough enough to do it. And so now, to me, the old dogs, getting to care for old dogs is just about the coolest thing in the world. Personality comes out more and more as dogs age. So you get a lot of wisdom, a lot of intelligence, and a tremendous amount of personality. So if you're interested in animal behavior and all this stuff that I'm geeked about, it's super, super fun. The cost of it, right, is the hospice care stuff. But to me, like it's much more of a blessing than a curse is all I can say. And it's just like what you end up sort of getting to learn from the old dogs is well worth it. For me, it is. I love it.
That is such a great title for a book. I geek out about stuff like that. So what I've learned from old dogs.
What I've learned from old dogs.
That's great. But yeah, that would be a concept. That would be a talk, at least, that I would really love to come here.
I'd have to think about it, but it's actually a really good idea. I'm going to think about what I've learned from old dogs. I'm not quite sure. Well, certainly be yourself. Wow. That's for sure.
Yeah. Show up just like you. That's great. I'm old enough. Just here I am. Great wisdom there. I heard you say, yeah, you were talking to Joe Rogan. And it was just this hilarious conversation about coffee. But that led into you making a remark that there are six things you do. Like you have this discipline. Could you talk about that a little? Like why those six things?
Yeah, so it's come from? So you got to start with the fact that the human brain is a goal-directed system, right? So goal-setting theory, just having, for example, high hard goals will give you an 11 to 25% boost in motivation. That's a big deal, right? That's a really big deal. That's like getting an extra 2 hours of work out of an 8-hour day simply for building a frame around the stuff you're doing. So when I train for performance, I always start by telling people they need a massively transformative purpose. Whatever it is, this is the thing, this is what you're here to do, whatever it is. I've got a couple things in mind. And then I expanded out of that. I was like, all right, I got three massively transformative purposes, three things I'm here to do. How many things do I need to do to support that? Mm-hmm. Right? So, and when I say that, it's, you know, I'm a firm believer that everybody should have a passion and purpose and they should keep it to them damn selves. Right. For the purposes of explanation, one of my massively transformative purposes, you know, I want to continue to write great books. I want to advance flow science and research. I might want to make the world a better place for animals. So those are the three things I focus on. To do those three things, I need to do six things in the world. So I do every day. I do some writing. I try to make the world a better place for animals. I try to advance flow science and research. I also have to tend my relationships, right? Friends and family. Right, you need, for performance alone, you need social support. Right, it doesn't have to be why, it doesn't have to be a huge social network. I have very few friends, but I try to connect with the people in my lives a little bit, especially because I'm prone towards solitude. Mm-hmm. Right, so I do that. I also have to do all the business stuff that I need to do to support those things. So I have to. I'm talking to you. I'm on a book tour. That's one of the things, and you know, there's a million other things. That's one of the categories, right? And then I have to throw myself down mountains at high speeds a couple times a week. Otherwise, I'm crazy upstairs. So I got to ski. I got a mountain bike. I got to surf. I got to run down a mountain. I got to do something like that. And those are the six things I do. And if it doesn't fall in that category, I don't do it. And one of the reasons I do this is we think we're defined by what we say yes to, because that's what the brain pays attention to. But we're really, really, our lives are really defined by the millions of things we say no to all the time, right? So I want to be very clear about what I say yes to and what I say no to. If it fits into one of those six categories, it's a yes. If it doesn't, it's a no. I don't do it. And I always, I have a firm belief, this is just me. I don't think anybody else needs to live this way. This is just how I choose to live, which is if I'm not working to solve a problem, I'm not talking about it. It's not mine. I only pay attention. Like if I'm going to get involved in something, I'm there to win. I'm there to solve it. And I don't need to kind of focus my energy on other places. So that map just tells me where to put my attention and where not to put my attention. And it allows me, you know, and I go from a massively transformative purposes to these six things. And then that allows me to translate those things into high hard goals. Right? making the world a better place for animals is a really big amorphous thing, but getting, writing a small furry prayer, that's a high hard goal. I want to write a book about the relationships with your last hang on cyberspace. I want to write a book about animal rights, evolution of empathy, and a whole bunch of stuff wrapped up in a thriller, right? Mm-hmm. That's a high hard goal. And underneath, and I can use that to shape my clear goals, which is what I do every day, right? So there's a stack, and it's what I'm trying to do is align motivation. So we have a bunch of intrinsic motivations. And if you really want to perform at your best, if you really want speed and momentum, you want all of them in alignment. Because the long haul is freaking long. It's hard here. Like, it's just hard here, right? And you need all, if you're interested in getting anywhere, you're going to need all the help you can get. I always say that 95% of what high performance really is just getting your biology to work for you rather than against you. So this is, you're getting your biology to work for you by aligning your motivation and doing this. So that's why I only do 6 things.
That's awesome. Do you ever have to go into an intuitive state because something is a little blurry and you're not quite sure? So you have to sort of get an energetic feel about a yes or a no.
So I said this, I don't know. I said this to the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago. They were asking me about psychedelics, which is not my favorite topic. But I said, to me, insight is the foundation of research. So there's a rule, the Flow Research Collective, which is insight, research, publication, communication. And that's the line I follow. So I don't talk about it out loud. I start with the insight, and that's where I start my research, right? And then I do my research around it, and then I write about it and publish it and get feedback about it, and then I'm willing to talk about it out loud, right? I'm trained as a journalist, and one of the things you learn as a journalist is have a really rigorous truth filter, really, really critical. And I have a very, 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 very rigorous truth filter that goes all the way out. It's funny. It sounds like I have all these rules for how I live my life, and it seems really, and what it really affords me is massive amounts of flexibility and agility inside my life. I just know exactly who I am and how I want to live. I'm lucky enough to be old enough to learn those things. Right. And also to figure out that, like, I'm just not good at anything. I can only kind of live one way. I'm not good at anything else. I don't fit easily inside of other people's boxes.
Totally. I relate 100%. And I get it. And I get that the idea, I've had this before in my life too, where I've actually had a recipe for something that was successful. And even though to someone on the outside, it might've looked like rules or rigidity, the truth is that recipe that worked created freedom for me. I knew if I followed this, I was going to get the result I wanted. Everything else extraneous was going to be cut away, and that there was tremendous freedom because I had all this attention to focus on other things.
I think there's a lot of, I think those kinds of exercises are really, 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 really useful. And I'm shocked more people don't do things like this. I'm always surprised by it. But I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, well, especially when goals become to the forefront, you know, it's important to figure out how to work them and be successful at them.
Well, the other thing is, I mean, we take in 400 billion bits of information a second on average, is the current calculation. And consciousness, what we can actually pay attention to, is 2,000 bits, right? So the vast majority of everything gets filtered out, right? And the vast majority of what gets through is stuff you're scared of. Right, because the amygdala, your danger detector, is the first stop that filter gets, and you'll note you'll get 9 negatives for every positive, sort of on average, 6 to 9 negatives for every positive, and that's just basic safety and security function. So your entire world is essentially sculpted out of tiny bits of information filtered out of this huge mass that's coming in. What gets in is chosen by your goals, other than shit that you're afraid of, right? The stuff that actually comes through is stuff that you have set goals around. It's your brain, because your brain is looking for that stuff, right? And your brain, we have special, we store information when we have unsolved problems. We store information in special circuits that are like flash circuits that are always constantly looking for answers, right? It's a different way of storing memory in the brain. And so knowing what your goals are, knowing exactly where you want to go, right, very specifically this way is very, very useful. The thing that's interesting, and the thing that the kind of new age gets wrong here with vision boards and The Secret and stuff like that, is you can't lie to yourself. So when you set goals, and you know, if you've never made more than $25,000 in a year and you're running around going, I am so happy and grateful that this year I made $1 million. Every time you say that out loud, your bullshit detector in your brain is going, you're out of your mind. That's not possible for you. And in science, we call this the Bannister effect. It's this very tight linkage between kind of brain and body. And it basically says you can't do the impossible. You can't take on a giant challenge, and you can see yourself doing that challenge. So you can't lie to yourself. Right. That's why you have to, like, when you're setting goals, they have to be just out of reach. If they're too far out of reach, your brain doesn't know how to get there. And it doesn't know what information to give you. Right. Like, it doesn't know how to filter reality. That's why that fails. Right. You have to have a much clearer map. But if you have a clearer map, your brain goes, oh, I'll give you this bit of information and this bit of information and this bit of information. And they combine together too. Right.
1,000%. I think that's also why, when creating a big goal and you actually have steps, or you reverse re-engineer something, right? You know, okay, this next step, well, it becomes a reality. The light goes off. It's like, okay, that was achievable. The next little step, that was achievable. Eventually you'll get where you're going. And I think those bites are.
I spent my career essentially studying people who have taken on capital I impossible, who have done things that people didn't think you could do at all, right? That's what I've done for 30 years, more than anything else. And that's most of what my books are. Even in animal rescue, right? Like, animal rescue is the most frontline, hard-edged of all the kind of causes. It's maligned. People don't even like the fact that you work with animals. Why aren't you saving children, right? Like, there's a whole bunch of that stuff. It's very, very difficult. And so the people I studied in the book you're reading, A Small Furry Prayer, the people who have been incredibly successful on the front lines of it, even that's a capital I impossible. But I always say that, like, we have capital I impossibles, and then we have small I impossibles. What I think is impossible for me, or what you think is impossible for you. And right. Over and over and over again, I will tell you that the only way anybody ever pulls off capital I impossible is that it's just, if you go keep going after small I impossible, after small I impossible, the thing I thought was impossible for me, the thing I thought was impossible for me, that eventually sometimes you get lucky enough to get to capital I impossible.
We're going to be back in just a second, exclusively for Dare to Dream listeners only. I have a unique deal for you, just for you guys, from Thinkific, and available only to my listeners. You can create, you can market, and you can sell your own online courses. Thinkific's powerful all-in-one platform makes it easy to share your knowledge, grow your business, grow your audience. And whether you're educating 10 students or 10 million, Thinkific offers the easiest technology and best support in the business. I've got my products up there. I'm super happy. It's drag and drop. And, like, for me, that's great. It looks spectacular. So for you as a Dare to Dream listener, use the link thnk.cc/deb. And you will get the first 3 months of Thinkific's business plan for free to set up your online course. The only way to get that exclusive free deal is to go to thnk.cc/deb. And if you're tuning in, I'm speaking with Stephen Kotler. He is a New York Times bestselling author, an award-winning journalist, one of the world's leading experts on high performance. You can find out more at stephenkotler.com. What have you found out in your life about setbacks?
I don't know what that means. Other than there's a number of different ways I sort of think about this, but you know, one of them is it sucks here. It just does. That's just the rule of the game. And it turns out, if you try to ignore the fact that it sucks here and numb yourself with television and beer, versus you try to dent the universe, right? It sucks for both people. And I actually think it sucks a little less for the person who's trying to dent the universe than the person who's trying to numb themselves with beer and television. Mm. right? And I think that's very, very true. I don't think, like, there's no way around that. Like, it's you're just going to get kicked in the teeth over and over and over again. I get up really quickly, right? I take the hit very hard, but I get up really quickly. I will always get up the next day and sort of keep going and just get up and keep going. And I will tell you, and anybody in high performance will tell you the same thing. One, every one of your kryptonites is your superpower, mm-hmm. right? My best friend and lifelong editor, guy who's kind of almost edited most of my articles and books along the way, his name is Michael Wharton, calls my career, my whatever I've done in the world, he calls it the empire that fear built. Which, I mean, he's not wrong, right? I have, like, I grew up, well, as a freelancer, coming up as a writer, you never had any frickin' money. I mean, I was poor, right? I was so poor for so long. And you were always trying to think, like, a story ahead or two stories ahead or three stories ahead. Or if I'm writing a story right now, I have to be selling five others. Otherwise, I'm not paying my rent next month kind of thing. And it was just this constant kind of future anxiety loop that I got into. But it worked really well over time, right? Like, being like that fear of, oh, shit, I'm going to run out of money 6 months from now. I better start hustling. Right, that was sort of built into me as a freelancer when I was still kind of bartending and writing and trying to build my career together. It never really went away. And that's also it's a punk rock thing. I heard Henry Rollins talking not too long ago, and he was like, yeah, I still expect somebody to, like, show up and be like, okay, you come with me, no more of that. Right. Like, I'm still, you know, it doesn't matter how many bestsellers I've written, I'm still kind of amazed that I get to do this for a living. I'm like, really? You're going to let me do this again?
You know? Is that imposter syndrome, or is that?
No, imposter syndrome was something that it took me a while to. I had that for a little while until I was actually doing actual flow science, like we were doing running real research. I felt like a little bit like I was up there, you know, as the guy talking about flow, but I wasn't. You know, I might have been one of the world's leading experts on it, but I wasn't conducting my own experiments. And so once we got our research lab up and running, that last bit went away. I don't think it was imposter syndrome, though I did. You know, I remember the first bunch of times I got to Wall Street or when I was working with the Navy SEALs and things like that, where you're in rooms with people and just like, are you sure? Like, it took me a really long time to believe that. So my philosophy is I see this all the time. High performance, people figure out how to do something really, really well, and they start training other people in what they figured out works for themselves. And it's usually a frickin' disaster because personality doesn't scale. Biology scales, right? So the people who are really good at this might have figured out what works for themselves, and then they backtracked it to the biology. Oh, here's how the system works. Let me teach you about how the system works. Because the system will work for everybody, right? The biology will work for everybody. Personality doesn't at all. It doesn't scale. You tend to make disasters out of other people's lives along the way. So that gave me some confidence in what I was training people in. But until I started, you know, we measure everything. And until I started seeing that this stuff really was effective, and, you know, I don't know how many, it was thousands of people who had to come up to me and be like, dude, your stuff changed my life, before I actually started believing them. Because mm-hmm. I'm a really skeptical guy. Mm-hmm. And if I'm going to stand on a stage and tell you something works, it really better work. Mm-hmm. And so that took a while. And it, you know, it was a long time before I would speak from a point of authority, right? I would go at things more from a maybe. Nietzsche used to call himself the philosopher of maybe. And I felt that way for a long time. It was only until the data started just piling up and piling up and piling up that I was like, oh, I think I can actually say this as something of an expert, rather than, you know, there's still caveats everywhere, but that took a while.
Thanks for your transparency. I really appreciate that. Stephen, this is Dare to Dream. What are you next Dare to Dream? What are your future dreams and goals?
Oh, you know me, total world domination.
With puppies.
Puppies, for sure. This is going to sound crazy, but I have 4 books coming out in the next year and a half.
Wow.
So there's, I'm, you know, I've got two more books after that. So there's a bunch of books that I'm working on that's coming next. And I'm really, you know, at the Flow Research Collective, we've now got 6 or 7 major research partnerships with major institutions. And, you know, my entire career has been spent on trying to decode the neurobiology of flow. And when I got into this 25 years ago, I remember a conversation with Dr. Andrew Newberg, where I asked him 25 years ago, I said, do you think we're ever going to actually, in our lifetime, do you think we're actually going to figure this out? He was like, no way. And I was like, yeah, I think so too. That's exactly. And now I will tell you, no, I act like technology has increased so much. We've learned so much. We're making such progress that I think sometimes in the next 5 to 10 years, we're not only just going to decode it, but I think we'll have a physiological based flow detector. And we're going to know a whole lot more about using, you know, the last century was about skills for performance, right? This century is going to be about states of consciousness for performance. And I think that, you know, and I think we're on the front edge of that revolution, and I'm hoping we can nudge it forward a little bit.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today and sharing your brilliance. It's been amazing.
Thank you for having me.
I end today's show with this quote from Israel Moore Ivor. Most great accomplishments do not look promising in the beginning. If you give up on a big dream too early, you have probably stepped on gold and mistook it for a rock. Next up on Dare to Dream, I'm featuring Carrie Samuels. She is world renowned for her astrology and numerology forecasts. It's just going to be a blast to hear what she has to say about the state of affairs and what's coming up. You can subscribe to Dare to Dream on all the podcast sites, also on my website, as well as right here on YouTube, and that's youtube.com/DebOnTheRadio. Thanks for being with us today. And remember, the secret of success is having the courage to begin in the first place.
To contact the award-winning syndicated Dare to Dream radio show, go to debbiedashinger.com. Keep your excellent feedback and comments coming. Your host, Debbie Dashinger, is an expert at goal achievement, a media personality, an international best-selling author, and a keynote speaker. Debbie leads high-quality teleseminars on how to achieve goals, how to be a self-published best-selling author, and how to get booked on radio. All classes are at debbiedashinger.com. Debbie's best-selling books are Dare to Dream, This Life Counts, sold on Amazon, and her second book, Wisdom to Success, The Secrets to Accomplish All Your Dreams, sold online at all bookstores. Tune in again to hear the next inspiring interview guest who has turned their vision into a successful reality. Want more support in making your dreams come true? Go to debbiedashinger.com. That's www.debbiedashinger.com. You'll see videos, MP3s, archived interviews, and amazing products sharing the secret steps to making your dreams come true. Remember to dream big with every expectation that your dream will become real. Dreams are free, so free your dreams. What do you dare to dream?
Here I'm standing now, waiting for my time to be here.